Okay, we got to, or did we get through this one? Sorry, yeah, we got through this one, didn't we? Apologies, sorry. Here we go. All right, so we did not get to this, correct? Just digastric is all we did, correct? Okay, so remember, just a review, we had the hyoid bone in the front part or the anterior part of the neck, horn shape or U shaped with some horns. Remember, it had a body in the front, two small horns or cornu going vertically superiorly to large horn or large cornu heading posteriorly, right? So any muscles that were above the hyoid bone are called suprahyoids. Any muscles related to the hyoid bone inferiorly are called infrahyoids. So of course, we're doing the suprahyoids first. We've already done the digastric. The next is called the mylohyoid, all right? I don't think we did this one, correct? Okay, so it arises from the inner surface of the mandible to the anterior surface of the body of the hyoid bone. All right, so we can see it here. It's that sort of what you would call the meaty part if you were to reach up underneath and feel musculature sort of on the medial aspect of the mandible, right? If we go back to the digastric, we've got, this sort of lateral either side, we have a very thin muscle here, and then the meaty part represents this myohyoid, sort of representing the whole bottom part here. And you can see it's relatively wide. Here's your digastric a little more in superficial here in relationship. And then we have this raphe, or sort of like a fascial sort of division between the right and left side. And we can see it sort of makes up a good amount of the bony, fleshy area. Here we're looking from a posterior view, and we're looking forward to the inside of the mandible. Here we have the myohyoid bone, and then we can see here the hyoid bone, and you can see how this muscle comes down onto the anterior part of the body. It is also a depressor of the mandible at the TMJ, and it too flexes the head at the spinal joints because of its position. Remembering, a muscle affects the joint when it crosses it. If we think of where this muscle is coming down on the inside of the mandible, just visualizing, think of where it is here, and it comes all the way down to the hyoid bone below. That means it's crossing the joints of pretty much C1, C2, and C3. Right? Because it's anterior to those joints, it does this. Hence the reason why, because it crosses those joints. Reverse motor action, when those upper functions are fixed, when the mandible is fixed, it elevates the hyoid bone when it contracts. Its innervation is the trigeminal nerve, cranial nerve 5. The next is the genio. Yes. Yeah. So if we look at the initial actions here, it says it's a depressor, right? So if, and it flexes the head. If I fix the cervical vertebra and I fix the mandible, and so in other words, they don't move, when this muscle contracts, the only now point of least resistance would be the hyoid bone. So when the mandible is not moving and the cervical spine isn't moving, the hyoid bone will come up. So its normal actions are those two, depressing the mandible and flexing the head and neck, but as a secondary reverse action, it would lift the hyoid bone when the other two are fixed and not moving. Does that kind of make more sense? It could help a little bit in swallowing, yes. More so though, when you swallow and feel movement, it's actually the thyroid cartilage of the larynx. It's actually moving because, again, we'll talk about this in a bit in anatomy, but remember you have the epiglottis, which is the door that opens and closes, whether it opens when we're breathing and it closes when we're swallowing so the food doesn't go down in your lungs, right? That opening and closing is the reason why larynx goes up and down, so that when you're swallowing, the epiglottis closes, not allowing that saliva to go into your lungs, which then goes down into the esophagus and into the stomach. So that's the reason why it moves. That's most of the majority you see there. Geniohyoid from the inner surface of the mandible to the anterior surface of the body of the hyoid as well. So we can see here we have a few muscles here. We have digastric just under the chin itself. We have the superficial digastric here that we've already gone through with the two bellies. And you can see it here nicely. Now it goes back here to the mastoid area, coming from posterior to anterior here, right at that smaller horn here. And we can see that the tendon here is associated to both the anterior head and the posterior head. So this is our digastric. Then we have the myohyoid here, which is the large fleshy part here, coming into the anterior body. Then we have geniohyoid, again, anterior body here, up here to the underside on the posterior surface of the chin. What the heck do we need to know all these muscles for? What do they have to do with massage? Anybody want to guess? Because they are very important. How many people here have had a whiplash? Guess what muscles get involved? These can get involved. Think of what's happening in a whiplash. Right, the head comes back in this case, and in doing so, as the head is traveling back, the body has a reflexive reaction to contract all these anterior muscles to prevent, of course, the head from whipping back too far, and then so you get muscle strains here, and you can get trigger points and pain and so on and so forth. So this is why I spend time here, is because it's not unusual for therapists to forget about these little tiny muscles in here that can really be affected by something like a whiplash. This is why we spend time here. Because in your treatment classes and in your past classes, you're going to go through whiplash and all its various grades and what it affects and so on and so forth. So this is why we need to know these, because they're very, very much involved in something like that, okay? So again, inner surface of the mandible to the anterior surface of the hyoid. You can see it here. It's a much smaller muscle as compared to the myohyoid, but very similar sort of attachments. It depresses the mandible at the TMJ. It flexes the head and neck at the spinal joint, very much the same as myohyoid because the orientation is the same, correct? It's pretty much the same. And, of course, reverse motor action is elevation of the hyoid bone, the same as myohyoid. Its innervation is hypoglossal nerve, cranial nerve 12, and it also has a spinal nerve innervation. So this muscle has both a cranial nerve innervation and a spinal nerve innervation. So we say it's innervated by hypoglossal nerve, cranial nerve 12, which is a cranial nerve, and then C1 has a nerve root that comes out of it. And we're going to spend a bit of time talking about that when we get to the spine itself. Just understand, a spinal nerve means it originates from the spine. So this muscle is innervated by a nerve that originates from the head, cranial nerve. It also is innervated by a nerve that originates from C1, the spine, spinal nerve. So it is a dual innervation of both these. That means that, if someone has a stroke, we might see some odd things happen here, but I'll just leave it at that, and you'll get into that in your neuro class. No, hypoglossal nerve. 12. It's 12, yes. Glossal's kind of tongue. Glossal. I remembered it. Okay. Next is the stylohyoid. What's that tell you right off the bat? Its name. What's that tell you? Stylite process to the hyoid bone. Correct. Okay. So, stylite process of the temporal bone to the junction of the body and the greater cornu. Remember, that's the horn, the two large ones. Stylite process of the temporal bone to the junction of the body and the greater cornu of the hyoid bone. Its whole role is to elevate the hyoid bone. Now, I want you to think about where the stylite process is. Does anybody bring their skulls with them? Okay. So let's think about where the spinal column bones are in relationship to the stylite process. Because you have to think. Remember I talked about how, where muscles are in relationship to the axis of movement has its reason why it has the effect it has, correct? I spent some time with that at the beginning. If we look here, one of these is better than the other, we can see the styloid process here, okay? And then we can understand where the spinal column is anterior here, kind of where my hand is, because you have a curve to it, all right? So the cervical spine has what's called a lordosis. So it curves like my hand, all right? Therefore, if my hand represents the cervical spine, Then where would the hyoid bone be in relationship to my hand? More posterior or more anterior? Anterior, correct. Therefore, this muscle has an orientation from posterior to anterior, right? Here's the styloid process here, okay? And it has to come this way to come to the hyoid bone. Everybody see that? Therefore, because it has a posterior to anterior positioning, what direction is the head going to go when this muscle contracts and the two attachments get closer together? It's going to extend, right? Because it's going to bring the styloid process closer to the hyoid bone. I'm over-accentuating here, but that's just to give you the idea of what's happening. So it's actually because, you know, sometimes when we look at orientation, it just has to be a millimeter or two. It doesn't have to be a huge difference. I am making it a bit larger than it is, just so you get the idea. So here's the hyoid bone. Here's the styloid process. So when the muscle contracts, the styloid process is going to get closer to the hyoid bone. Therefore, that is extension. Does everybody follow that? Everybody understand that? Any questions on that, or anybody need some clarification? Kind of the first opportunity where we've had to talk about something that seems a bit picky, but it truly is. Just, again, got to consider that orientation of where it is in a three-dimensional sense when we relate it. No, it's the extension of the head at the atlanto-occipital joint. By the sheer fact that the styloid process is attached to the temporal bone and the hyoid bone's up here, if it's going to pull on the styloid process, then the entire head's going to go into extension at the orientation between C1, right? So at the atlanto-occipital joint means it is the articulation between C1 and the occiput at the occipital condyles that we talked about. So when that muscle pulls at those occipital condyles, the head does this along that occiput C1 joint. Okay, so you get extension. Everybody kind of understand that? So when you are looking at muscles in the future, and for example, do you know, all know that pectoralis major is actually a shoulder flexor? And you go, huh? Because it doesn't make sense to you initially, right? You think, well, how does that work? Because it's because in the anatomical orientation, the glenohumeral joint lies posterior to pectoralis major. Therefore, it initiates flexion. It all has to do, again, remember, like that's why I brought that all up in the beginnings of the course. You have the axis of movement. Knowing that a muscle has to cross a joint in order to affect it, it is the orientation of that muscle, wherever it lies in relationship to that axis, that results in the movement that it does. And this is our first really good example. Styloid process, more posterior, hyoid bone more interior. It crosses the joint between C1 and the occiput, therefore we get extension. Okay? Yes, no, maybe? All right. I hope so. Its innervation is facial nerve, cranial nerve 7. So we can see it here. There's your styloid process back here posteriorly. See how the orientation here, it's in yellow? See, it's posterior here to the styloid process and then comes anterior to the greater horn of the hyoid bone, hence the reason why it will pull this posterior aspect closer to the hyoid bone, which results in cranial extension at C1, at occiput C1. Okay? That's your superhyoids. Now we're going to go to the muscles that lie below the hyoid bone. Of course, these then would be called the infrahyoids. The first is called the sternohyoid. Name tells you what, likely? Sternum to the hyoid bone. So, it arises from the posterior surface of both the manubrium of the sternum and the medial clavicle. So, our sternum, we have three parts of the sternum. We haven't really gotten into that, and that's for a few lectures ahead yet, but understand that this breastbone, the sternum that we have, is made of three parts. Superiorly, it's called the manubrium, and the manubrium actually means shield. So it has this kind of odd shape that anatomists way back when felt it looked like a shield of some culture, I don't know what, but looked like a shield. Then we have the long part in the middle that's called the body, and then at the very tip, you're all probably familiar with this term, we have something called the xiphoid process, right? So manubrium superiorly, body in the middle, xiphoid process at the bottom. So we say here then, looking at the picture, going back, it arises from the posterior surface of both the manubrium of the sternum and the medial clavicle. Your clavicle is your collarbone, and your clavicle articulates with the manubrium at the sternoclavicular joint. Okay, so you've got your manubrium here superiorly, you've got your clavicle coming across to your collarbone, and there's an articulation between the clavicle and the manubrium and the medial aspect. So we're saying that this muscle arises from both the posterior surface of the manubrium and part of the clavicle, and of course you have a right one and a left one. Okay, should probably go back and say that in terms of digastric and some of these hyobones. Although we talk about one, you actually have a right and left, correct? Okay, so do somewhat keep that in mind. So we can see here then we've got this posterior attachment here distally, or proximally, posterior manubrium and clavicle. And it arises to the inferior surface of the bottom of the hyoid bone. And that would kind of make sense, right? It's an infrahyoid, so it's going to come up and attach on that inferior aspect of the hyoid bone. Its actions depresses the hyoid bone, meaning what? Pulls it down, pulls the hyoid bone down, and it flexes the neck and the head of the spinal joints. Why does it flex the head and the neck of the spinal joints? It crosses them. That's the first right answer. And the second is, where is this muscle in relationship to the cervical spine? Anterior. So therefore, if your axis of movement is the cervical spine, the sheer fact that this muscle crosses those joints, you get movement. And the muscle lies anterior to the axis of flexion. So therefore, because it's anterior to the column, it causes flexion of the spinal column. Yes? Yes. Yep. Digastric did. Yep. And we're going to talk a little more about the hyoid bone. Yeah, so that you've got the body at the front, you have the two lesser that kind of stick up superiorly, and then you have the two greater that travel posteriorly back. Its reverse motor action elevates the sternum. That means when the hyoid bone is fixed, it will elevate the sternum, but that's a pretty minor role. It's a pretty small muscle to lift the whole sternum and all that weight with it, but it does do it. Innervation, now we have left cranial nerves with this muscle. This is innervated by two levels, C1 and C3. So maybe it's time for a small related anatomy review, because we're going to get into this shortly, but maybe I'll jump ahead so that makes a little more sense to you. What we're going to talk about when we get to the spinal column . I'm just going to do a few vertebrae here. Okay, so we have related vertebrae here. We'll call this C1, C2, and C3. Then what we need to do is we need to put some discal material in there. That's the reason why they're separated. So there is a disc here and here, okay? Sort of this disc that sits between the two. You'll take note that when we relate the two together, I may make this a little more obvious to you. Okay, we have a hole right here and right here. Do you kind of see that? Okay, now above here at C1, of course, we're going to have the cranium, which contains the brain, the medulla, and so forth. What would run through here, sort of between the body and these knobby looking things that I've drawn, so running down through here would be, what, does anybody want to guess what's running through here? That's not quite anatomically correct, I apologize, but what do you think this purple thing is? The spinal cord, correct, okay? So the spinal cord kind of runs through there. Now, the spinal cord is an extension of the brain, which is the extension of the central nervous system. sensory information from the body, the fact that you all think it's cold in here right now or whatever, that's information that's coming from the body to the brain to say, hey, it's cold in here. Those are known as sensory neurons, right? They will leave whatever part of the body and go to the central nervous system, spinal cord, which goes to the brain, which then you consciously say, hey, it's cold in here. We have a whole lot of body here, you know, from the neck all the way down to the toes. And then we have a spinal column we're going to talk about that kind of goes from the, you know, the base of your head all the way down to kind of almost your butt, okay, at the sacrum. And on there are these building blocks that stand one on top of the other all the way down. So any sensory information that's coming back from the body, right, whether it's coming from the great toe or whether it's coming from your little finger, what is that? Oh, interesting. Okay. So, I talk loud, though. I'm okay. She doesn't talk so loud. She doesn't talk as loud as me. I know that. So, you've got all this information that's coming back from all these parts of your body. How does that information get to the spinal column, therefore then the spinal cord to get to the brain to do it? It enters through this little space right here and here. This is known... as the intervertebral foramen, okay? That's how you get access into the spinal cord, but at the same time, I just talked about sensory, we also have to have motor instructions. In other words, your ability to influence a muscle to contract. The same thing happens. I have an entire column and an entire bottom, top and bottom. So if I want to make my big toe wiggle or I want to make my thumb wiggle, that stimulation from the nervous system comes at various levels. There is no way that a stimulation for my big toe to wiggle would arise from C1. It's way up here, it's too far. So to wiggle your big toe would be all the way down to the bottom to your lumbar spine, right? What we're saying here in this slide is that this muscle is innervated by C1 and C3. That means that the nerve that exits the spinal column, thus the spinal cord, that innervates this muscle, come from two areas. C1, so this muscle is innervated by a nerve that exits at C1 and a nerve that exits down here at C3. So that's what it's telling you. Does everybody understand that? Okay. Now there's some more complicated stuff that happens before it gets there. But understand that when I say C1, C3, that's where the nerve is originating from that sends the message to say to this muscle, please contract. Okay? Does that make sense now? All right. We're going to get back to that. So we can see it here. It can elevate the sternum and flexes the head and neck and depresses the hyoid bone. You can see the whole bunch of them here, right? We've got quite a few of these infrahyoids in here. The next is called, sternohyoid, right? Next is the sternothyroid. So, this is the only hyoid muscle that does not directly attach to the hyoid bone. Yeah, I might want to highlight that statement. Okay? So, it is called an infrahyoid, even though it does not attach to the hyoid bone. It arises from the posterior surface of both the manubrium of the sternum and the cartilage of the first rib. So sternohyoid originated from the manubrium, but the clavicle, sternothyroid, is the posterior surface of the manubrium, but the cartilage of the first rib. Okay, so this one goes all the way down to the first rib. If we look at the anatomy here, we can see that the first muscle here, if we just go back for review, the sternohyoid arises from here, right? The manubrium and the clavicle, whereas sternothyroid arises from the posterior manubrium and the cartilage of the first rib here. So this is the clavicle and manubrium, articulation for hyoid, sternohyoid, and then manubrium and cartilage of the first rib for sternothyroid. Oh, dear God. Okay? And this does not go to the hyoid bone. This goes to the cartilage of the thyroid cartilage of the larynx. So it goes to here. So we can see here's your sternothyroid here, right? First rib and body of the manubrium. And it does not attach to the hyoid bone up here. It actually attaches right here on the thyroid cartilage. The thyroid cartilage lies inferior to the hyoid bone. So it does not go to the hyoid bone. It goes to the thyroid cartilage of the larynx. That's the little milk pour spout here, the Adam's apple. So this muscle attaches superiorly to the thyroid cartilage, or what you would call the Adam's apple, not all the way up to the hyoid bone. They're pretty close to about the same. If anything, maybe the hyoid bones may be just slightly posterior. Yeah, one over the other. Have you guys palpated it yet in lab? The hyoid bone? Yes. Okay. And you probably palpated the thyroid cartilage as well, yes? Yes. Okay. This depresses the thyroid cartilage. It also can flex the head and neck of the spinal joints, again, because it lies anterior to the said joints. And the same as sternohyoid, it elevates the sternum as well. And, of course, its innervation is, again, C1 and C3, same as this muscle. So sternohyoid and sternothyroid have the same actions and the same innervation. The only thing is sternothyroid does not attach to the hyoid bone. The next is called omohyoid. It has two bellies. It has an inferior belly and a superior belly. So we can see here, I thought I had a picture here. Why do I not have a picture here? That's kind of weird. What we can see here is the two bellies. Do you remember digastric had the two bellies? Remember it had an anterior belly and a posterior belly? And then it found attachment on the lesser cornu there, and it shared the tendon. So we can kind of see it here, right? Right here. You see how we've got the mastoid processes here, and then it came around, so the posterior belly came from the mastoid area, and then it shared a tendon with the anterior belly, which found attachment on the mandible, and they shared the tendon here. Everybody can see that? The same thing happens here with omohyoid. What you can see is there is a superior belly here that's anteriorly, and then they share a tendon, and that tendon goes down and attaches on down here onto the clavicle, and we have a posterior belly. So omohyoid, the inferior belly goes from the superior border of the scapula. Now think of where that scapula is in relationship to the anterior neck we're talking here. So this muscle arises from way back here on the scapula and crosses all the way and comes all the way anteriorly to that tendon. Superior border of the scapula to the clavicle via the central tendon. And then the superior belly goes from the central tendon of the clavicle to the inferior surface of the hyoid. So we can see here in the diagram, right, we've got the two bellies are here. We've got, which was the better? Here we go. So here is the inferior belly here. Now this part of the muscle, it doesn't show it in the diagram, but it's coming from the superior border of the scapula back here. So it's traveling all the way across to come to the tendon, and you get this configuration where the tendon finds attachment on the clavicle, which we can see here. And then the superior belly comes off that same tendon and travels superiorly up to attach onto the inferior surface of the hyoid bone. Does everybody follow that? Yes. Yes. I thought you asked if we are going to palpate. That's why I was saying no. Yeah, it's quite deep. But that doesn't mean that you can't get a little bit in here, because all this is lying what? Anterior to the spinal column. That being said, who would like to volunteer to come up? And I'm going to palpate a couple things here. I want someone else. You've already done it a couple times. I want somebody new. Yeah, come on up. So, the thing to remember when we're doing this clinically, which should come on this side, maybe a little bit. I'm just going to go on this side. So we're going to orient ourselves here. We've got thyroid cartilage here. We've got the trachea that's quite movable. He's got a clicky one, okay? So And I mean, there's a lot of musculature either side here. We get to talk about, we have scalenes, we've got sternocleidomastoid, and so on and so forth. So what I'm talking about is I need to get behind the trachea to the anterior bodies of the cervical spine, and I can do that. Yeah, everybody's like, not to me or not. Okay, so I'm going to literally just move that trachea a little bit out of the way and come right in here, and I'm touching his anterior body of his cervical vertebra right now. So in here, I can't differentiate these structures we're talking about, but I can certainly get in here and affect them. Okay, so and then I'm below, so here's his larynx here, so I'm a little bit below here. So I'm going to go a little bit higher and get into that space, and right in there, I'm touching the cervical vertebra. I'm not in the position. I'm nowhere near his carotid artery or anything like that. And that's the one thing you'll have to learn, is that when you get into this area and palpate, if you were to feel a pulsatile mass that's going whoop, 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 and it's pushing against your hand, you might want to get off it. Okay? So I can actually get right in here, and I'm touching his anterior cervical spine right there. Okay, thanks.
Feels weird.
Now, if you had someone who had a relatively acute whiplash and I was getting in there, my touch would be feather-like almost, right? Because you're already getting to some sensitive tissue there anyways, but you can affect change into these to some degree. Just can't individualize them out, that's all. Okay? So, of course, went the wrong way. So, omohyoid, then these two bellies. Remember, it comes all the way back from the scapula. That's a long way back anatomically when we're looking at it, all right? And then the superior belly, and then the inferior belly and the superior belly share a central tendon, and the central tendon is also the point where we find attachment on the clavicle. So again, we go back to this picture. You can kind of see it. Where's my laser? Here we go. You can kind of see it right here. Here's where they share the central tendon, and then the central tendon finds attachment on the clavicle. Okay? It depresses the thyroid cartilage when we're swallowing. Right, comes up and down. It also flexes the head and neck of the spinal joints because it is anterior to those joints, and its reverse motor function, when everything else is fixed, is to elevate the sternum. Its innervation as well is cervical plexus C1 and C3. Am I in the wrong one? Oh, sorry. Yeah, you're right. I went the wrong way. Here we go. Sorry. Depresses the hyoid bone, flexes the neck and head, elevates the scapula. That's the other difference here. Because it has that attachment of the inferior belly, goes all the way back to the scapula, it will pull it down. It pulls the scapula down a little bit, okay? So pulls it down. Innervation is still cervical plexus C1 to C3, right? C1, C3. So this is how you stretch them. Yes? C1, C2, C3. The stretch here, you cannot individualize these muscles with stretch. You would stretch them both as a group. So what you see here then is you see extension with contralateral rotation. It's not really rotation. It's kind of, we call it the stargazer. So if you are standing and you have a star up here to your right, you look up at the star, that would be the stretch for it. Okay? Last one here is the tongue. The tongue is extraordinary. It is a boneless mass that you can protrude at will, fold, invert, lay flat, or fill the mouth. So it does a lot of movements. How many people here can do circles with their tongue? How many? Do you know it's genetic? You can do three. I've had students who can wiggle it like a worm. I've had students who can twist it upside down. I've had students who can make a tube out of it. It's all genetic. And you either have the gene or you don't. I can't do it. I don't have the gene. Yeah, and you can twist and turn yours, right? So it's all control of muscle within the tongue itself. I figure at one point you were like 5 years old looking in the mirror because you saw it at school, and you're like, I wonder if I can do those things. And you started to discover you can do all these weird things with it. So it is an unusual muscle because if you think about it, it does all these movements that you just did with no bony attachment. And it's all embedded within the tongue itself. So I don't spend a lot of time here. It's just to introduce you to it again in terms of how it works and what it's made of. But we don't go into it in any depth at all whatsoever. It's just to introduce you to it. So we have extrinsic muscles of the tongue and we have intrinsic muscles of the tongue. So the intrinsic muscles only attach to other structures within the tongue. So they don't go outside the tongue to attach. They're all within the tongue itself. By the way, how many people here have eaten a tongue? Tongue is delicious, man. Oh, tongue sandwiches. Mm-mm-mm. A little bit of Havarti cheese, some hot spicy mustard. Yummy. I often want to bring a beef tongue. Has anybody ever seen a full beef tongue? Yeah, they're quite large. There are four paired intrinsic muscles of the tongue, and they're named by the direction of when they travel. So they're paired, and they're named by how they travel. First is the superior longitudinal, running along the length of the tongue. Then we have an inferior longitudinal. So we have a superior and an inferior running the length of the tongue. We have a transverse muscle set of muscles. That transverses mean muscles, obviously, that would run along the transverse plane. And then we have a number of verticals which go up and down or superior inferior. These muscles affect the shape and the size of the tongue, for example, in tongue rolling, and have a role in facilitating speech, eating, and swallowing. The tongue is extremely important. Because without a tongue, if I was talking to you, all you would hear is... Okay, so down here, the larynx makes noise. Our ability to speak language, whether that's Italian or French or German or English, whatever it may be, it's how we move our tongue in relationship to the that we create in our larynx. You look at some languages, especially very indigenous languages, and I think in other countries, the tongue is used to click and to pop when we speak, right? So their tongue is involved in making sounds that is part of their speech to have things. By the way, what's supposed to be the hardest language in the world to speak? No. Vietnamese. You can say the same thing. It's your intonation that'll say one thing or another. They say that Vietnamese is actually harder to speak than English. I don't know if there's any Vietnamese people here. I don't think there's anybody from Vietnam. I've had a few Vietnamese students in class over the years, but yeah, they say it's harder than English. The reason English is hard is not because of the tones, it's because of the stupid way we spell. GH can be guh or uff, like, which makes no sense at all, right? Right. You look at the word enough. If you're learning it as a second language, you go enough. And they're like, no, it's F. And you go, yeah, but SF. How is GH an F? Right. Motor innervation for the intrinsic muscles of the tongue is via the hypoglossal nerve, cranial nerve 12. You're going to learn a neurological test if someone's having a stroke. If the hypoglossal nerve has been affected in a stroke on one side, the tongue will pull across. Meaning that if I have the stroke of this nerve on the right side, when I stick my tongue out, the one on the left is still working, so my tongue will do this. I'll try to stick it out straight. I can't because the left side's paralyzed and the right side's functioning properly. Therefore, it's going to, just through contraction, it's going to pull the tongue to the unaffected side. That's a test you're going to learn. It's actually a neurological test to test someone for dysfunction, dysphagia. I mean, you might see a patient that are acting kind of weird and kind of go, can you stick your tongue out? And you can go, I think you might want to go to the emergency department right now. Or it could be someone who's had a stroke some time ago and you're trying to get a sense of how their function is since they've been, you know, treated for the stroke, that kind of stuff. Okay, so that was the intrinsics. So you have superior, inferior longitudinals, you have transverse, and you have vertical muscles. The extrinsic muscles, of course, find attachment outside the tongue. The first is called the genioglossus. Its function... The inferior fibers protrude the tongue, the middle fibers depress the tongue, and the superior fibers draw the tip back and down. So, quite literally, can you stick your tongue out? That is the inferior fibers. Can you flatten your tongue down in the roof of your mouth? I bet you many of you can't. You can flatten the front part, but how many of you can flatten the back part? It's hard, isn't it? You want to flatten that tongue down into the either side of the mandible, not just the tip. It's hard, isn't it? It's because you spent your entire life pushing the tip of your tongue up into the roof of your mouth. It's one of the issues with TMJ stuff. And then the superior fibers draw the tip back and down. Remember I asked you to try to touch the soft palate? Remember you tried to get your tongue back to touch the soft palate in the palatine bone? That's, you were doing that. The hyoglossus depresses and retracts the tongue. So you can pull your tongue back. You can stick it out, but you can pull it back. Right? Okay, that's hyoglossus. The styloglossus functions to retract and elevate the tongue. The platyoglossus elevates the posterior aspect of the tongue. That's about as deep as we're getting. All of these intrinsic and extrinsic muscles are innervated by hypoglossal nerve, cranial nerve 12, except palatoglossus, which has vagal innervation, cranial nerve 10. So you can see them all here as they lay out. See, you've got vertical muscles, you've got transverse muscles, you have longitudinal muscles, and these are your extrinsic muscles here, right? This is the tongue here. Purple represents styloglossus, again, to the styloid process, but I'm not getting that deep into it. The name kind of tells you, but I'm not going to be asking questions from that perspective. Just understanding how the tongue functions and understanding this cranial nerve relationship, again, because you are at some point going to be doing nerve testing for cranial nerves in your either your assessments class or in your neuroanatomy class, okay? We're done, right? Now it's the spine. Woo-hoo. We're getting along. We're getting there. Bring out your spines. How many people do not have a spine? So right now we're finding out why it is so important to have a spine with you or a vertebra, because when I say on here are the articular processes of this spine that run this way back there, you're going to go, there's no way I can see this little thing. So if you've got one, could you mind sharing a little bit so someone can at least have one to look at? Or sit by them or do something. And there's not one at this table right here. Did anyone figure out how to kind of put it all together? What's that? Yeah, but did anybody do it? Or they just kept them loose? Did he? Okay. Oh, well, that's a cool idea. Why not? Okay. So I introduced you a little bit here when I was talking about the intervertebral foramen, sort of a basic introduction to the spine itself. So we also can call this the spinal column or the vertebral column, but quite often we call it the spine, and of course it is part of the axial skeleton. It is stabilized by ligaments, which limit the motion. We have back muscles, which also provide support. Again, structure governs function. It is the shape of these various vertebra. They have basic parts to them. They all have those basic parts. There are some that are modified a bit more than others. But fundamentally, between the ligaments, the muscle relationships, and the shape of the bones themselves really determines the stability, the movement, and so forth of the spine overall. And we'll talk a whole lot about that. There are 33 vertebral bodies in the spinal column, of which only 24 are movable. The others are fused, and we'll get to those a bit later. But they are sort of all singular to themselves. You can see there in the drawing I did previously, I always try to say that, you know, the spinal column is kind of like a children's building blocks, you know, kind of sitting one on top of the other, kind of sit all the way along. And, of course, the only difference is when we look at the spinal column, we have this rubbery kind of disc that lies between. There are three areas. Actually, there are a number of areas of the spine itself. There's the cervical area, which represents the neck. There is the thoracic area that represents the torso or the thorax of the body. There is the lumbar spine or lumbar area, which is the lower back. And then there is the sacral spine that represents the sacrum, and then the coccygeal spine, which represents the coccyx or the vestigial tail that we had inside mum. So there are seven cervical vertebrae, which means there are seven in the neck itself. So seven cervical vertebrae in the neck. There are 12 thoracic vertebrae. How many ribs do we have? Somebody said it. 12, right? So there are 12 ribs and 12 cervical or thoracic vertebrae. There's a relationship there that we're going to learn about. So 12 thoracic. We have 5 lumbar vertebrae, which are at the lower part of the spine. There are 5 sacral bodies that all fuse together to form what we call the sacrum. And then there are 4 coccygeal bodies that form what is known as the coccyx or the tailbone, right? Little tiny part that comes out of the bottom of the sacrum. When each of these areas are named by the type of vertebra. So I will start saying C-spine or L-spine or T-spine, representing, of course, cervical, thoracic, or lumbar. It's kind of the common way we talk, whether that's chiropractic, physician, physiotherapist, massage, doesn't matter. We'll say, you know, C12, T1, L4, right? That's telling you C-spine or T-spine or L-spine and which segment it is. So they are numbered, okay? So they are numbered. We start at the base of the skull to the extra or lesser lumbar vertebra. I'll get into that a bit later, but just understand that we said the sacral body are five vertebrae that fuse together to form this mass. That means that from a putting together point of view, there are some individuals whom they get an extra fusion. So they have 6 sacral. So that means that's going to lessen the number of movable segments, or they don't fuse enough together, so therefore they end up with an extra vertebra because it was supposed to fuse, but it didn't. But we'll talk a bit more about that.
Are they fused like right away, or do they take time?
Inside mum. By the time you come out, you have a fully formed sacrum. Yep. So when we count them all together, we get the 24, and or 24, we might get 25, or we might get 23. So we always count from the top down, from C1 downwards. Vertebral bodies become larger as they approach the sacrum, and then become smaller as they approach the coccyx. So if you look at your vertebra, right, you'll see here that you've got a very large mass, or sort of an anterior mass. And then you have this other part where you have all these things sticking out all over the place, okay? So to take a look at a vertebra, you'll see you've got this sort of thick, large area, and then you've got these bones sticking out in all different directions. So what I'm talking about is that when we look at the vertebral bodies, this is a lumbar vertebra, and you can see that the body is quite large here. This is a cervical vertebra. This is the body here. So you can see a definitive difference between the bodies themselves, and why would that be? Yes, we need a much larger body in the lumbar vertebra because they're carrying the entire load of the body from that point upwards, right? So pretty big amount of mass. And then when we add movement on it and those sorts of things, it only increases the vectors of force immensely. So we have a large, large body in the low spine to deal with all that kind of mass. Whereas, why would we have a small body in the neck? I mean, that pumpkin that sits up there is not light. It's about movement, right? So it's built in such a way that we get the vast range of motion that we get in the cervical area and the head, right? We don't have that same kind of motion in the low back and the pelvis because we don't want that. We need stability down here, whereas there's been modifications so that we do have that range of motion in the neck that we can get. And that part of that is just how small these vertebral body are. Okay? So the vertebral bodies become larger as they approach the sacrum and become smaller as they approach the coccyx. And, of course, this has to do with the increased weight. Generally, their columns are between 72 and 75 centimeters in length on average. And a quarter of this length here, we'll say 75, a quarter of that length is made up by these discs that lie between the vertebra. You see, when I show you lumbar vertebra here, for example, you know, you put them together and you see they'll fit quite nicely like that. But there's a problem here. There's no disc there. So what they really fit really should be is like this, because then we, you know, these two don't quite line up, but you get the idea. There's a disc that lies there that fills in the space under normal circumstances, right? Of course, because it's soft tissue, it's long since decomposed and it's gone, so all we have are the bones to deal with, okay? So we can see it here. We've got our 7 cervical, we've got our 12 thoracic, and we've got our 5 lumbar. Sacral is 5 that are fused to form this mass that's the sacrum. We do have a sacrum here. It kind of looks like this. This inverted B represents the sacrum. You see the circles here. So between those circles would be a body, a body, a body, a body. Okay? And then the coccyx is down here. It's partially fused, and it represents the tailbone. So we here, okay? So we say, you can see it down here, 3 to 5 fused vertebra at the very bottom, which represents the coccyx. You can see it here as well. It's in color. And, you know, of course, if you're going to do your spine just like that, you line it up appropriately so you know which is lumbar and then thoracic and so forth. Okay? Now, it, of course, supports the trunk and limbs. It's what allows us to stand upright. At some point, from an evolutionary point of view, we went from 4 legs to 2 legs. And we can see that evolution in the primate world, right? There are primates who can partially stand but can't fully stand, right? You'll notice that most primates can walk on 2 legs. It tends to be kind of unusual, right? It's because of their pelvis association. But they can't stand for the length of time like we can on 2 legs. They have to go back down to 4. Anybody heard the reason evolutionarily why we went to 2 legs? Aliens. Yeah, Space Odyssey 2001, right? They reached down. And why are we on 2 legs? One theory is it's so we could see above the savanna grasses to see if anything that was bad, like a saber-toothed tiger, was coming to get us. What's that? Oh, yeah, I use that term all the time, especially when it comes to flight and fright stuff. But that's the thought. But when we did that, when we went to 2 legs, because, okay, here's a question for you. So let's go back here. There are 7 cervical vertebrae. How many cervical vertebrae do you think a giraffe has? Sorry? The same. They have exactly the same amount. But they've modified the size of their vertebra to give them the neck that they have. Okay? Do you think giraffes have problems with their cervical spine throughout life? I would suggest that, yes, they probably do. They probably have higher incidence of arthritic changes and so forth because of how their neck works. I don't know if you've ever seen 2 males fight. They whip their head like a whip and smash their heads together, right? So when we decided to go up onto 2 legs, we've paid a few prices for that. Hence the reason why we generally tend to get some back pain and we tend to suffer a little bit from it. We also get, even if we don't have back problems, we do deteriorate our low back. It does get deteriorated where the discs start to grind down. It's not unusual for that to happen. It's just the fact that we decided to go on 2 legs. So the spine plays an important role in posture during sitting. Remember I had you guys sit and put your bum on your hands, and I wanted you to feel your bum bones be somewhat balanced on the seats, right? What's important to understand about that is when you're sitting on those 2 ischial tuberosities, and that's what they're called that you're sitting on, those 2 bones, if you're equally weighted on both those bones, you've taken all the stress off your spine. Because what's happened is the weight of the upper body sitting on your pelvis, that weight gets distributed through those 2 bones out into the seat, and it's a lot less stressful for the spine. The moment you move off of that into the various postures that I see here in the room, you're putting excess weight in areas of the body where it doesn't belong, and then you start to increase the probability of disc degeneration, postural muscular pains, aches and pains, and so on and so forth, right? And this is why, you know, I don't know if you guys have seen any of the research over the last number of years, but they say that sitting all day is as bad as smoking a pack of cigarettes. It's just so bad for your body. If you look around the college, there's many people who have stand desks. Does anybody here ever own stand desks to work? Yeah, right, to be able to stand all day or sit and stand. It's much, much healthier than just sitting like you guys are for 3 hours in a lecture class, right? It's quite often students tell me they get sore backs after a semester of class. It just starts to bother them, right? So sitting is not the greatest thing in the world. We've tried many things. How many people here have sat on a BOSU ball, you know, while they're working? Remember, those were popular for a while and all sorts of things. So I think stand desks are the best. Up, down, you know, always changing posture. Moving, shifting, changing, right? A neat little trick to do for you guys sitting all the time. Sitting, believe it or not, if I stand and sit so you can see the posture, it's actually like this. So this is what you're like in the chair, but you don't realize it because you're sitting down, okay? So what you want to do is the opposite. So every once in a while, if you're feeling a bit tight in the back, go back, right? Get over the top. Open up that chest wall. Get those hands out. Get a nice little, right? And then come back again. Some of you might get a cramp. Oh, these chairs aren't good for that because you're just going to go back like a lazy boy. Right? So you're spending so much time doing this, do the opposite every once in a while. Okay, the other thing is, ladies, I call it breast posture. And that is, our culture puts a lot of emphasis on that area of the body in females. So females become very aware and whether a female is large-breasted, small-breasted, and everything in between, they start to protect. So our culture actually forces a posture that females do. And that is forward flexion and internally rotated upper arms. What they're doing, in fact, is they're actually hiding that part of their body because of our culture. Okay, and in doing so, they suddenly set up this posture. Okay, so ladies, so the best thing you want to do is, of course, externally rotate those hands, get those shoulders down and back, and lift that chest up. Try it. Shoulders back and down, relax the head, lift that chest up, give the back a break, and all of you, I can tell, all of you feel like you're like this right now, don't you, right? Because your brain has intrinsically changed to think that this is normal posture. When you stand in appropriate posture, you're not as exposed as your mind thinks that you are because you spent your entire life hiding. Just relax those shoulders back, lift that chest up, and you'll take a lot of stress off your back. Give it a try if you can. It's very beneficial. That's the worst. That's normal. All right, okay. The other thing it does, it of course, transmits the weight of the body through the pelvis to the lower limbs. So our ability to walk and move forward has had this relationship of the pelvis twisting, coming up and down, doing all these things. And how does that happen? Because of the spinal column, and we have to transfer the center of gravity in our body weight in the relationship to our foot in order to function properly to be able to walk or to run. It also, of course, protects the spinal cord and spinal nerve roots. This idea, you know, you can all see in here, there's a relatively large space here, right? And that is where the spinal column runs, is down through, the actual spinal cord runs through this space here as it works its way through. Now, here's the thing. Well, why have I got a picture of a boat here with sails and a human spine? Let's talk about the boat for a minute. So you have a big, tall mast in that boat, right? And you have sails on there, okay? So you take that boat out, that big sailboat out with the mast and the sails on it, and you unfurl those sails. Yes, I do read. You unfurl those sails, and the wind hits. You have a strong wind. If you're not stabilizing that mast, what's likely to happen? It's going to snap, right? The sails will open. They'll put stress on the mast, and the mast will bend to a point where it'll snap. Well, we're the same way. What I want you to recognize in the human side of the picture here, and we'll look at the spine itself, where is the majority of mass as it relates to the spinal column in that diagram? Yeah, but where in relationship to the spinal column? Anterior. So we live in a world under a particular kind of influence called gravity, right? So if we think of the mass being anterior to the spinal column and we're under the pressure of gravity, where does that mass want to go? Down and forward, correct, right? So we have to offset that, right? We have to offset this want of the mass to go down and forward. How do we do that? The same as we did for the mast in the sailboat. Number one represents guy lines. So if you look at a massive sailboat, you will find all kinds of lines that have nothing to do with the sails, but are in fact actually stabilizing the mast from all different directions, so that in any way that mast moves, when it bends to the wind, it won't snap because there's lines that stabilize it. Everybody follow me? We're the same way. All our mass is anterior, and it wants to travel down and forward. So back here, we have to have guy lines that keep us from falling forward. So you can see that red line on the posterior aspect all the way up to the skull. That is one modification that exists to prevent that thorax from falling down and forward, and that are muscles called erector spinae. In other words, we have a muscular system back here that is always working, including our head, and preventing everything from wanting to come down because we are, in fact, under constant gravity and it's wanting to move down and forward. We also have joint modifications that prevent this, and we have lots of ligaments that also prevent this from happening. Well, because we're constantly under this influence, and they're always working, you can see the potential for overwork, getting tired, and pain patterns that bring people to see us. Because the majority of your work is going to be on the spine. People are going to come with back pain. And maybe many of you have gone to seek help for back discomfort and dysfunction. It's all because of the way we're set up here. So when we decided to get up on 2 feet, we now have to make modifications to deal with all this mass that's wanting to move down and forward. Okay? So part of this also is the spine is not straight. So the other modification to deal with this configuration I just discussed is that the spine has curves. So what have I got? What's that got to do with curves? What is this, first off? What is this? It's a Colosseum. It's still one of the largest freestanding structures in the world. Why can it stand like that? Yeah, so what are those curves called? Right, arches. So the Romans discovered, from an engineering point of view, something called the arch. Without the arch, this building would have collapsed within months after it was created, because the weight of stone on stone on stone on stone, the lower stones would not have been able to have taken the amount of accumulated weight above it, and eventually the thing just would have crashed to the ground. But it didn't, and it's still with us. Why? Because the arches take the weight that's above it and transverses it to other areas. So in so much, it still weighs what it weighs, but the arches have prevented the collapse simply by taking the weight or the energy above it and dispersing it outwards and outwards and outwards. So you'll see every layer has arches. And the reason for that ability to be this high and that large and not collapse is because of what those arches do. What's the key part of an arch? Does anybody know? The very top one in the middle, and what's it called? It's called the keystone. So that little, you don't have to write that down. This is just for information. So it's a wedge-shaped stone that sits at the top of the arch. And it's the beginning. So the weight sits on top of that keystone, and then the keystone, because of its relationship to all the other stones in the arch, that's how the weight just all gets transversed. So with that in mind, we have curves in the spine. Those curves act like arches. They too modify to take the mass and the weight of the body and disperses it by, and therefore taking a lot of stress off the spine and lowers the potential of pain and discomfort and maybe allows the spine to last so many more years. So there are four anterior-posterior curves in the lateral view. We have curves in the thoracic and sacral spines that are concave anterior. Okay? So we're saying that we have two curves in the thoracic and the sacral that are concave anteriorly. This is known as a lordosis, or we can say that it is lordotic. Okay? Oh, what have we got here? So, what do we do backwards? Sorry, I did a kyphosis. I'm paying too much attention to what I'm saying and not what I'm doing. You're all right. I apologize. Sorry about that. These are kyphosis or kyphotic. Okay? So that's your thoracic and your sacral. The cervical and lumbar are concave posteriorly. So they go like this. And these are said to be a lordosis or lordotic. We need to maintain these in order to prevent issues as well. Quite often, something, again, this is one of my little back pocket things, someone comes to you with low back pain, see whether or not they have a good curve in their low back, and you'll find the majority of them have a flat back. I always see some patients, and they'll get on the table, and they'll say, oh my God, we could eat a dinner off your back. There's no curves at all. It's so straight and flat, hence the reason why they're running into problems. So we have thoracic and sacral spines are concave anterior, known as kyphosis or kyphotic, and the cervical and lumbar areas are concave posterior. They're known as the lordosis or to be lordotic. The curves provide flexible support, and we already talked about that when we looked at those arches in the Colosseum. Loss of curves results in weakness of the column, both structurally and mechanically. In other words, when we lose the curves, the forces can't be transferred and just loads on top of the spine and causes destruction of the discs and pain, the muscles, and so on and so forth. Yeah, you had a question? There are structural or functional reasons for losing the curve. So you can have bony changes that unfortunately affect it. That's not our ability to change. Surgery sometimes can do that. But if the loss of the curve is due to muscular tightness and those sorts of things, yes, we can absolutely change it through exercise, hands-on techniques to lower tone of muscle and so forth. Yeah. Yeah. Usually those are functional. So I give them exercises to try to get them back, such as lazy push-ups. So lying on your tummy and just pushing your chest off the floor, trying to get those muscles in. And of course, then I would have associated techniques where I would try to lower the tone of the muscles in that area, get them to release so that it's easier for the spine to turn. And the other thing, of course, is strength, right? Getting those back muscles strong to get that spine into alignment as well. So we can see here's our lordosis and cervical, thoracic kyphosis, lumbar lordosis, sacral is a kyphosis, and we don't worry too much about the tailbone, but these are the curves that we wish to maintain when we look at someone from the lateral view. And you're going to see a large variety, and there's a number of different ways that can happen. Like pregnant ladies have, that excessive, right, lordosis. We call it a sway back, where the fetus, being as much weight as it is, again, under gravity, the fetus is pulling down and forward, so the woman's curve gets accentuated, almost looks like the bum's sticking out a bit more because of such a stronger curve in the L-spine. The thoracic and sacral curves, the thoracic and sacral, which are said to be what? Kyphosis, right? They're primary curves. In other words, they are created inside mum. The primary curves are the result of the differences in the height between the anterior and posterior parts. The cervical and lumbar develop after birth. So if anybody here is a newborn baby, go home, have a look at their back. It'll look as flat as a tabletop because they're not walking yet. So the secondary curves, cervical and lumbar, they start to form after the child is able to walk, stand up tall. Weight of the body starts to affect the spine, and you get the secondary curves, which are the cervical and the lumbar. So the cervical and lumbar develop after birth, cervical when we're able to hold up our heads, and lumbar when we can walk. The fact that some people have abnormal curvatures can be due to abnormal development and pathological processes. I'm going to finish here, and then we'll take a break. One of those is osteoporosis. We've all heard of that. What happens is these vertebral bodies anteriorly become very, very brittle, and they start to break and crush down. So in doing so, as they get smaller in the thoracic area, grandma starts to look like she has more and more and more and more of a hump in her upper back, right? That can be through And when you get an excessive curve in there, and, you know, it's called hyperkyphosis. There is also a condition called humpback, which usually occurs in the thoracic region. And basically, this hyperkyphosis is a posterior curvature of the vertebral column and is also known as a dowager's hump. Anybody here got a grandmother who doesn't got hasn't got osteoporosis but has this big kind of hump in their upper back to their neck? Anybody have that with a bit of the fat pad there? It's really genetic. So there's a good chance you'll get it. Yeah. Yes. Scoliosis. Now, scoliosis is not curvature in the anterior-posterior view. It is curvature in the medial lateral view. So scoliosis, it's convex laterally, and it can result from an asymmetrical weakness of vertebral muscles or from failure of the body to go together properly. So if it's due to weakness, we can affect some change in scoliosis by doing treatments of relaxing the long parts and strengthening and so forth and getting balance back. Hyperlordosis, of course, is this excessive curve, especially in the lumbar area, and this is an increase of the convex anterior known as sway back. So here is Grandma. She's got osteoporosis. The vertebral bodies start crushing down, and in doing so, the spine shortens, results in this hyperkyphosis here. We get the extension of the stomach because as the spine's coming down, where are the organs going to go? Path of least resistance, which is anteriorly because of the soft tissue, right? So you get sort of this configuration here. You can get a kyphotic spine that's hyperkyphotic. This has to do with, can be a number of reasons, poor posture and so forth. We sort of see here in the x-ray view. This is a scoliosis that we see here, and you get these lateral curvatures. And as I said, this can be the result of anatomical associations between vertebra, or it can be the result of weakened muscles or overly strong muscles that kind of pull it one direction or the other. We can see here that here is the sway back. So we have the hyperlordosis here, really common in dancers and gymnasts and that kind of stuff. So more so with young ladies who, you know, when they're quite young are doing these sorts of things, because is this not, if anybody here is into gymnastics, is this not the appropriate position we want the athlete to be in when they're done? Yes. Maybe even cheerleading is too, right? Same idea, right? You want that excessive lumbar curvature, it seems to be the position that gets you the higher scores. But it does result in having this excessive movement here. Athletes as well, you can see here, we have hip flexors here in the red. And if we have problems where people have excessively tight hip flexors, it can rotate the pelvis and result in this sway back or excessive lordosis in the lumbar spine as well. And you can see it in this gentleman here. There's a bit of excessive here, and this is the correct one. Okay, take a break. We'll see you guys at the top of the hour. Okay. Let's get back to this, shall we? All right, so we were talking about the curves in the spine, that we had anterior-posterior curves with convexities, either anterior or posterior. We also had a discussion on some other pathologies, such as scoliosis, which had curvatures laterally, depending on which way they went. Okay, and you're going to get into a lot more of those when you get into musculoskeletal pathologies, I think it's semester four. So let's talk about this vertebra. So we can see here that there's... how I'm going to introduce it to you is, you know, the basics of the vertebra, and then we're going to get into the specifics. So I'm going to give you the overall, what is a vertebra, and then we're going to look at the cervical spine, lumbar spine, thoracic spine, and so forth, and some of the modifications based on the basics. Okay, so right now we're just talking the basics of a vertebra. So grab, the best is the lumbar vertebra is the best one to work with. If you have one, the bigger, thicker one, it's just a bit easier to work with. The parts are a bit larger, and you can see them much better. Okay? So, a typical vertebra is composed of a body, which we can see here in green, right? So we have the body in green and the arch, which is in purple. So we have two parts. We have the big, thick body, and posteriorly, we have all these bones heading off in various directions, and these are known as the processes, of which there are seven of them, which we're going to talk about. Of course, as we already have talked about, they vary in size and other characteristics from one region to the other. Again, going back to structure governs function, depending on what their role is, right? The C-spine has a different role than the T-spine, which has a different role than the L-spine. They have certain configured, they're configured slightly different, but they still have the basics of seven processes and a vertebral body, except for a couple of them who have even further modifications. But we'll get to those. So let's talk about the body first. So your orientation is that the body represents the anterior portion of the vertebra. So it's the one that's facing your belly button. So if you think about it, you look at that body, it's actually facing the belly, and this is the anterior portion. It's generally, they become larger, particularly from T4 inferiorly. Now, so when I say T4, that's telling you that that's the fourth thoracic vertebra downwards, okay? So from T4 down to L5, remember there's five lumbar vertebra, they get progressively larger. The body gets progressively larger. It's the heavier part, and it's actually a short long bone. Don't ask me why. Okay? It's a short long bone, all right? It gives strength, obviously, to the vertebral column, and of course, the reason it gets progressively larger is because it supports a lot of the weight, right? So you need the large one. From C3 to S1, they become larger to progressively bear, of course, this increasing body weight. So we can see the body here, meaning the anterior part. The next is known as the vertebral arch. So let's start drawing here as we go along. I did have a black one. I don't know where it went. It's okay. It's over here. So first thing we have, of course, then is the vertebral body. So now we have the arch. It lies posterior to the vertebral body, and the vertebral arch is attached to the body, and it protects the neural tissues. So within this, and I already showed you a little bit of the space, we have the spinal cord that runs between the body and the arches, all right? It's formed by two pedicle, two lamina, four articular processes, two transverse processes, and one spinous. We'll get to those piece by piece. Don't worry, we're going to get piece by piece. Within these arches, we have a space known as the vertebral foramen. Okay, so if I just put a circle here, remembering that this is anterior here, and this is posterior here, we then have this idea, we have a bit of a circle here, we have this space, and this is known as the vertebral foramen. Okay, and if you did your terminology, foramen is a hole, basically, okay? Successive vertebral foramina form the vertebral canal. So if you were to stack your vertebra one on top of each, on top of each, on top of each, and you look down from top to bottom, you would see this foramen makes a hole from the skull right down to your bum, okay? All the way down. And that whole accumulation of all the vertebra and all the vertebral foramen form, right, the spinal column or the vertebral foramen or the spinal canal, okay, looking all the way down through. So they all come together to form that. Within that, we find the spinal cord proper. We find the skins that surround the spinal cord. These are known as the meninge, okay, or meninges. The nerve roots, which are the ones that break away and head out to go to where they're going, which we did in the intervertebral foramen there with the little red circles when I was talking about muscle innervation, and blood vessels. Okay, so they're all running within here. Anybody here had an epidural? That's where they stick the needle, is through the meninges into this area to inject the anesthetic that affects the nerves that results in what you get when you have an epidural done. So this is where they're going, down in the lower area. We'll talk a wee bit about that a little bit later. So here we've got, here's the foramen right here, and here we have all the different processes, the pedicles, transverse processes, the laminae, we've got the spinous process and so forth. And we can see it here in the real bone, and we're going to talk about all these things right here today. So the first are the pedicles, and I've drawn them in here. There are two of them, and the term pedicle actually means little feet. So there are two. They're attached to the body and are continuous posteriorly with the flat lamina. So I'm going to continue here. I'm going to just rub this off a little bit here now that I've put it up there. And we're going to move this way. Okay, so we have here in the red these two little feet here called the pedicles. Okay, known as the pedicles. And they're attached to the body, and they're continuous with a flat area called the lamina, which is here in purple. Remember, they're surrounding this frame in the center, right? There is a small notch superior to each pedicle called the superior vertebral notch, which varies in size at different levels of the vertebral column. Underneath each pedicle is another notch called the inferior vertebral notch, which is usually larger. So when I drew that diagram earlier today, I drew a diagram that looked a little bit like this. Okay, so this area here represents the pedicle, right? We're saying that there is a notch superiorly, the superior notch, and there is a notch inferiorly, known as the inferior notch. So, there's a notch inferior to each pedicle called the inferior vertebral notch, and there's a notch superior to the pedicle called the superior vertebral notch. When two vertebra articulate together, so I'm going to put the disc in here, so these two vertebra are articulated together, they're adjacent to each other, and those two notches, so the inferior notch of the superior vertebra and the superior notch of the inferior vertebra. Does everybody follow me when I say that? Right, the inferior notch of the superior vertebra and the superior notch of the inferior vertebra, they come together and form a bony ring called the intervertebral foramen. So the two notches in the relationship to it. So I can actually take a couple of bones here. And you can see, so from the side here, we can see that the pedicles, if you look down on your body, you'll see two little feet there, the two pedicles coming off the back. So that would be here and here, okay? Then we'll go to this view, this lateral view, and you'll see there's a bit of a superior notch, but a very large inferior notch here, right? Fairly significant inferior notch. When I put the two vertebrae together appropriately, pretending there's a disc in there, and these two don't fit well. See if I can do it this way. It might be easier. I'll do it this way. Can you see the big notch that's created? See the big foramen that's created there? Right? You can see the foramen that's created. This is known as the intervertebral foramen. Kind of looking right through it there at everybody. Everybody notice that and see it? See it on your own when you put the two together? Okay. So, when two vertebrae articulate, the vertebral notches are adjacent to each other and form an almost complete bony ring called the intervertebral foramen. We have nerves that go into and out of this foramen. So this is the entrance and exit, the entrance of sensory nerves going to the central nervous system, and the exit of motor nerves, those nerves that stimulate muscle contraction, are exiting. So sensory nerves go into and motor nerves come out of the intervertebral foramen at each level. So we have One between every vertebra, except for the head and C1. So we have an intervertebral foramen between C1 and C2, C2 and C3, C3 and C4, C4 and C5, all the way down to the sacrum. And out of every one of those is either a sensory neuron coming in to feed sensory information, pain, cold, hot, so forth, or we have a motor neuron that's heading out of that intervertebral foramen, which will stimulate muscles within that area that it innervates. Yes? Right. You have both. You have both at the same time. Yeah, and remember, you have a right and left. So you also have them going right and left because we have to innervate the right side of the body and we have to innervate the left side of the body. So you see that, so there's a hole on that side, but there's also a hole on this side. So if this is anterior, this would be the left-hand side, the nerve root exiting that side. This would be the right nerve root exiting this side. Okay? So picture them as coming down and spreading out, coming down and spreading out, and so forth. Okay? I don't know if I have a picture of that or not. I don't think I do. All right? So we can see here is our pedicle here coming off the vertebral body posteriorly. And from the lateral view, here's the inferior notch and a bit of a superior notch here. And again, they come together with the disc to form this ring right here, which is known as the intervertebral foramen, of which nerves either enter or exit the area where we find the spinal cord within that canal. Yes? Yes. So there's two that go out and two that come in. Right. See here? You can see it here. So here's the spinal column here. Okay. This is the spine. This is the actual neural tissue. Okay, of the spinal cord. And we can see we have what are called nerve roots. So because they're originating from here, we call them a root. And you can see that there is what looks like one thing going in there. Within the skin in here, there is a nerve that's sensory and a nerve that's motor. All right, so one on each side. So breaking away from the spinal column that we can see here. Okay, does that make more sense when you see that picture? Right, so when someone has like a disc herniation where the material pushes against there, this is why they might get pain down their leg, because this nerve might be responsible for the muscles in your big toe. And it gets irritated, so you don't feel pain in the back necessarily. You might feel pain in your big toe, because that nerve's been irritated. Yes. Sensory always comes in, right? Because it's taking information from the outside and giving it to the brain. And motor, meaning the nerve that's going to affect things like muscular contraction, right, which is its majority of its role, it exits the spinal cord to go out to the particular muscles that it's responsible for. Okay? Any questions? Any other questions? That's for which? Yeah, when I say C1, C3, that's telling you that's the level by which that motor nerve has leaving the spinal column to go to that muscle. Yes. Yeah. I'm going out. Correct. Right. So when I tickle certain parts of your face, the reason you feel it is because whatever level or cranial nerve is responsible for sensory in this area is sending a message back to the brain to say, hey, somebody's touching my face, or pain, or heat, or cold, or whatever, right? Sorry, you had a question back there? If there's some blood supply that will go in and out here as well. There's also blood vessels that travel down through those meninges through the whole spinal cord. Yes. So we say then dorsal and ventral nerve roots are found in the vertebral canal and the spinal ganglia, which is the dorsal root ganglia. They're also found in the intervertebral foramen. For our purposes right now, just understand that nervous tissue is either going into the spinal cord or leaving the spinal cord, and they enter and exit through each of these intervertebral foramens that is between every single vertebra as we work our way down. We're going to get into that a little bit deeper. Don't worry. Except for, well, kind of. story. I wouldn't ask a question at this point on that anyway. Okay? The next is the lamina, which I have there in purple. These are the vertebral processes all arise from the lamina. So all the other ones we're going to talk about, they arise out of this lamina. There are typically 7 processes that are related. 3 are lever-like, so this means they're used for muscle attachment, so muscles attach them. And 4 are articular. We have 2 superior articulating processes and 2 inferior articulating processes on each side to give us a total of 4. So we have right and left, okay? So we can see here, here is our pedicle, here is our lamina, and then we have processes here all rising from it, okay? So I'm going to do this. Actually, I'm going to rejig this just a bit for you, just so you get a sense of it. Okay, so this is the inside of the lamina. And off of that, we still have the frame in here, but we're going to start building it off of that. So we can see here, the hard part is to understand these articulating processes in the three-dimensional sense. So here is the lamina. Here's our pedicles here and here, and here's the lamina, and I've drawn the inside part of the lamina so far. Off this lamina arise all these other things, these 7 processes that come off. When we look at the lateral view here, here's our vertebral body. Here is the pedicle that we see here, and then we can see that all these processes come off of it. I said that there are these articulating processes, 2 superior and 2 inferior, meaning 2, 1 on the right, 1 on the left, 2, 1 on the right, 1 on the left, right? Everybody follows me? So 1 on each side. Okay, so when we look at the diagram here, this number 3 is the superior articulating process of vertebra number 4. Does everybody see that? Right? 3 is the superior articulating process for 4. And 3 will articulate with the vertebra above with its inferior articulating process, which is right here. Does everybody understand that? Right? So you got here, here's vertebra 4. Here's its superior articulating process here that we'll call 3. And then you can see there's a bit of an articulation here between where 3 is and the vertebra above, in this case is number 6, but I think it's looking at a rib, but we'll say that. Right here is an articulation, and that is between the inferior articulating process of this vertebra, more orangey, and number 3, which is the superior articulating process for 4. Yes? No? Maybe? Yeah? Okay. So if I take a couple of vertebrae here, smaller, we can see here on this model, here's our vertebral body and here's our pedicles. Here's our inferior notches and we have a bit of a superior one. When I turn it this way, you'll see there are 2 pieces sticking up either side, yes? This is the superior articulating process sticking up on either side. If we look underneath on this part, we can see 2 flat surfaces here and here. These, again, are the superior articulating processes. Down here, these 2 little small flat pieces are the inferior articulating processes. When I bring in another vertebra, like so, I thought I grabbed another thoracic. Here we go. I'll bring another one here. Again, you can see we have 2 superior articulating processes, 2 inferior articulating processes. When I bring the 2 together, the inferior articulating processes are going to articulate with the superior articular processes like that. Everybody understand now? Make sense now? Okay. We can do backwards, do the other way as well, however we want to do it. But just understand that we have 2 superior and 2 inferior, and they arise upwards or downwards from the lamina. Okay. So again, the 4 articular processes, 2 superior and 2 inferior. The superior articular process articulates with the inferior articular process of the superior vertebra. Does that make sense to you now when I say that? Yes? Okay. The superior articulating process articulates with the inferior articulating process of the vertebra superior to it. Right? All right. So the common name of the joint that's created between these two articular processes, if you've heard this before, if you've gone for physio or for chiro, they'll call it a facet joint. Anybody heard that term before? Your facet joint's out, right? They have to adjust it and get it back into shape. That is not its appropriate name. Its actual proper anatomical name is called the zygapophyseal joint. The reason we call it facet is easier for laymen to understand it. But facet, terminology-wise, only means flat surface, right? But they are flat surfaces, and they do slide and glide, okay? They are joints that way. So its appropriate name is a zygapophyseal joint. But you will hear exclusively, pretty much most of the time, people in this kind of business will call them facet joints. Yes. Usually facet joints. But I will ask a question or two to make sure that you know that's the proper name. Because you will come across it in research literature, and you should know what it means, right, when they're using it appropriately. So sometimes I force you to know some of these names because at some point you are going to be looking at research, and it's quite conceivable that the researchers have used the appropriate medical term for it so that you know what it is and what they're talking about, okay? So we're saying that this facet joint of the zygapophyseal joint is the articulation between the articular processes of the vertebral arch, of which we know that the superior articulating process articulates with the inferior articulating process of the vertebra superior to it. I'm repeating it just so you understand it, okay? I'll probably lay in bed and think about it this morning or tonight when I'm going to bed. What it does help, it helps to prevent anterior movement of the superior vertebral body on the inferior one. So when I talk earlier about, you know, gravity and all the mass being anterior, when we look at it from a vertebral point of view, okay, from a vertebral point of view, it would be fair to say that under the influence of gravity and the fact that the majority of mass is anterior to the vertebral column, all the vertebra superior want to go forward and down, don't they? Just like the mass does. They all want to go forward and down. So one of the things we talked about was that muscles and ligaments helped prevent that spinal column from coming forward and down. So too to this configuration. It can come forward and down because the articulating process is in the way. So it helps maintain stability in the spinal column. Okay, make sense? Yes, no, maybe? Okay. So it prevents the superior one from moving forward on it. The placement of the zygapophyseal joint influences the type of movement that can occur between the two vertebra. When I'm discussing the C-spine versus the T-spine versus the L-spine, one of the major differences in all three areas is how the two associate to each other. So when we look at these articulating processes and their relationship to each other, completely influences how much and what kind of movement can occur between each vertebra, which results in the overall movement that we say that each of the spine has. So in other words, the C-spine has lots of rotation, lateral flexion, flexion extension. The thoracic spine is flexion extension, a lot more rotation. Lumbar spine has no rotation. It's all about flexion and extension and lateral flexion. Okay, and it is the relationship between the superior and inferior articulating processes and the associated zygapophyseal joint that influences what kind of movements occur there. It'll come, because we're actually going to go through all of them, each of these individually, and talk about their associations, okay? So we can see here, this is the cervical spine look. So we can see this is the inferior articulating process of C5. This is the superior articulating process of C6. You can see this configuration. They kind of lie like this to each other, don't they? Right? You can see here, the superior one kind of leans back like this. And the inferior one comes forward. So we say that the superior articulating processes faces posteriorly and superiorly, and then the inferior articulating process faces posteriorly and anteriorly. Can you see that in the picture? Superior faces superiorly and posteriorly. Inferior articulating process faces inferiorly and anteriorly. Right? Did I say posterior than previously? I think I made a... Yeah, I think I did. Sorry. Okay. I think I might have said that. Sorry. So you can see. So this relationship between these two processes allows for the ranges of motion that the cervical spine can give you because of how these two relate to each other. Okay? We can also see it here. We can see the zygapophyseal joint here all set up. And it is a synovial joint, which means what? Sorry? Free moving. What else? Diarthroidal attack. Yeah, what else though? What structures does it have in it? Fluid.
Fibrous capsule.
Fibrous capsule. Articular cartilage, so on, so on, so on, okay? So when people say I have arthritis in my back, it's this joint they're talking about because the disc that we're going to talk about here at some point, it's not synovial. So it can't have these traditional arthritic problems. So when someone has arthritis in their spine, it is this joint that we're talking about that they have a problem with, created by these two articular processes, okay? It lies posterior to the body. It's in all of them. It's in every single vertebra. The only place we don't find it is C1 and the occiput. But it's between every vertebra from top to bottom. The next one is called the transverse processes. And they say exactly what they mean. They travel transversely across, right? So they project laterally from the junction of the pedicles and the lamina. And these are sites for pulleys and muscle attachment. So if we go here, we've got the pedicle here. So we've got a transverse process here. And we've got a transverse process here. Okay, these are your TVPs. So they head at either side. And they act as attachments for muscles, helping increase their leverage over the vertebral column. I will put a little circle here and here, and this represents the articular process. Just so you kind of know where we are here, okay? Little circle kind of represents that, all right? So we have our two pedicles, we have our articular processes, and we have our transverse processes. We can see it here on either side, transverse processes here and here. The next is called the spinous process. Now, it projects posteriorly or posterior inferior in the medial plane. So you can see here, I'm going to use this particular model. So we have our vertebral body. We have our two pedicles. We have our superior and our inferior articulating processes. We have our two transverse processes. They're not heading completely straight out laterally. You can see they are a little bit posterior. Well, we can see the two TVPs here, and then we have one that sticks right out the back here, sticks right out the back. This is your spinous process, okay? So your spinous process projects posterior or posterior inferiorly in the median plane and from the union of the lamina. So we can continue here with pink. I didn't give myself much room, but basically this is the spinous process. Right, and you can see that we've left ourselves here, again, the lamina here. So lamina sort of represents this area here. Actually, a little more to kind of here. This would be considered the lamina here, sort of to here. And the two transverse processes come out from either side, and the spinous process out the back from the lamina as well. And they serve as attachments for what is known as the interspinous and supraspinous ligaments. When you look at someone's bare back, you know the little beads that you can count in some individuals going down? That is the spinous processes pushing against the soft tissue that overlays the back. What you're looking at is the tips of the spinous processes. Yes, that is what you're palpating. At this point, you're palpating the tips of the spinous processes, correct? Yes. And these supraspinous, interspinous ligaments, they're, again, they're another modification to help provide support and stability to the spinal column. The spinous process also helps to provide some posterior protection from things getting in at the spinal cord itself. So we can see here in the C-spine, here's our articular processes we can kind of see here. Here are transverse processes kind of sticking out a bit. You can kind of see them. And then we have the lamina here, and then we have the spinous processes sticking out the back. Believe it or not, you can palpate all these structures, and you will learn to palpate the majority of them. You can palpate the lamina. You can palpate the articular cartilages or the zygapophyseal joints. You can palpate the spinous processes and the transverse processes, and you'll learn all of them. This is C-spine. You see this configuration. This is what it looks like in the T-spine. So we have a little bit different association between the superior and inferior articulating processes. We can see the spinous process here as compared to the C-spine. The spinous process is much longer, and it travels downward as compared to the C-spine, which travels downward, doesn't stick out quite as far, and is nowhere near as long. You'll also note that the spinous process in the C-spine is split a little bit on its tip, said to be bifurcated, whereas the T-spine is straight. And then in the L-spine, again, the articulating processes are yet again another type of association to each other, and we see the spinous processes here as compared to the T-spine, where they're quite sharp and have a tip to them. The L-spine is actually flat and square, said to be spatulated, looking just like a spatula, square and flat. Okay? We're going to learn all these individually, but just showing you that there are differences in the basic structures of a vertebra. Okay. I think we have 5 minutes, don't we? Yeah. Let's not waste our time. Don't be putting your stuff away yet here. So as per usual, we've done the bones, now we have to do the joints. We'll get started on the joints. I've already alluded to both of them. I talked about a disc anteriorly, and I talked about the zygapophyseal joints. So that's the only joints we have to worry about for the spinal column. So the first is the typical joint is called the posterior facet joint, also known as the zygapophyseal joint. And as we've already discussed, this is the association between the inferior and superior articulating processes of vertebra. We just discussed this, right? The superior articulating process articulates with the inferior articulating process of the superior vertebra, right? Okay, so this is the joint we're talking about. They are a plain synovial joint, which means they're diarthmoidal that permits sliding and gliding only. Okay, that's how they work together. The articular surfaces, again, because it's synovial, are covered with hyaline cartilage, which of course is surrounded by a thin articular capsule, which attaches to the margins of the processes. And of course, on top of the synovial membrane is the fibrous capsule, correct? Now, because we need to have significant movement here, which allows for spinal range of motion, this capsule is quite loose. If we had a tight capsule, it would restrict our ability to move. So the capsule is loose, which allows for the amount of range or movement that occurs between these structures. Okay? So when we look at the differences between C-spine, T-spine, and L-spine, of course, the capsule is going to be far looser in the C-spine as compared to the others because the neck has a greater range of motion. Whereas we have a tighter capsule around the lumbar area, yes, we want some movement, but we need more what in the lumbar spine? Stability, right. So therefore, again, structure governs function, right? This joint helps control flexion, extension, rotation, and lateral flexion. So flexion, extension, rotation, and lateral flexion, either way, okay? And again, like I said, the way they associate to each other is going to influence how much of any of these movements occur in C-spine versus T-spine versus L-spine, okay? So you can see here is the joint that's been exposed. We see here the zygapophyseal joint, which of course is a synovial joint, and here we see it with its capsule intact, so we can see how it's associated there. This is another picture of it where we can kind of see through the capsule. We can see the relationship between the two processes here, covered in the capsule again, because it's synovial with hyaline cartilage, synovial fluid, and so on and so forth, right? sometimes, as I said, people get arthritis in their back and it's in this joint. And one of the things they can do to alleviate discomfort, usually done by an anesthetist, is they'll stick a needle through the back and then go into the joint between the two bones and inject an anti-inflammatory in there. Many people find relief with this, some not so much. So it works some most of the time, but some not so much. They generally do tend to freeze the tissue that the needle goes through to get into this structure. I get it done. My SI joint gets done all the time. It's not as painful as you would imagine. It's a very tiny needle that goes in, and it does give a significant amount of relief, so not so bad. The anterior vertebral joint, then, is the disc. It is a symphysis secondary cartilaginous, and we all know what that is now, right? What a symphysis is? Remember, hyaline cartilage on the bone with a fibrocartilaginous disc in between? Remember that? Yes. Okay. So, they are adjacent. The adjacent vertebral bodies are linked by an intervertebral disc from C2 to S1. So between C2 and 3, 3 and 4, T1, all the way down from C2 all the way down to L5, S1, between every vertebral body is a disc. Every single one has a disc between it, okay? There is no disc between the occiput and the atlas, nor between the atlas and the axis, and we'll get into those later. The disc unites the vertebra into continuous semi-rigid column, so it allows for this column to be able to move, but at the same time be strong enough to keep us standing upright. It accounts for 20 to 25% of your overall height. Basically, it's a shock absorber. It just helps with prevent some over-movement, but also helps with the forces that travel through the spine. When we look at this configuration of these vertebral bodies and these discs, they have to be held into place because they're strong, but they're not quite strong enough. There are three holding elements to the vertebral bodies and their relationship with the disc. First is the disc itself. So the disc, the way it's built, does help hold the vertebral bodies together. Then there are two ligaments, one to the front of the vertebral bodies and one to the back of the vertebral bodies. So they are the anterior longitudinal ligament. So this is a ligament that runs literally from inside the skull all the way down to the sacrum, and it lies and attaches to all the anterior faces of every vertebra all the way down, and it also lines part of the inside of the skull as well. So it comes out of the skull and goes all the way down the front of every vertebra all the way down. We also have what's called the posterior longitudinal ligament. It arises not from in the skull, but from the outside of the cranium all the way down in that space. So the anterior longitudinal ligament lies here, and the posterior longitudinal ligament lines here. Here from the skull all the way down to the sacrum, here from the outside of the cranium all the way down to the sacrum. So we have two ligaments, one in the front, one in the back, that attaches to both the front of the vertebral body and the back of the vertebral body all the way down, which we can see. I thought I had it here. Don't have it. Anyways, you see the drawing of it there. Oh, I wish we could finish this off. Okay. I guess we kind of have to be done. I'd love to finish the thought and then get back to the other stuff, but that's okay. So everybody knows next week there's no midterm on this, just a quiz, and we'll be continuing class after next week, right? Adios, amigos. Lots of stuff, huh? What's that? I wish you could finish it. It just keeps the continuity better, right?